sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the speech given by author and New York University professor Mark Crispin Miller, given at the Left Forum on May 30th, 2015. He's the author of the book Fooled Again on election fraud in 2004 and has written several other books and made a movie about the crackdown on our civil liberties called Orwell Rolls in His Grave. My apologies in advance for some of the sound quality. The speech was taped live, so you can hear background noises and the frequent opening and closing of the door. But I think it's a speech really worth hearing. So here he is, Mark Crispin Miller, at the Left Forum, talking about the left and 9/11.
Of course, we want to bring this subject to the public and debate it at the very highest levels. Naturally, we do. I mean, there's no question but that a lot of really bad has happened since 9/11. It seems glaringly obvious that it's happened. So why is it that it's not being debated nationally? And why is it that the left isn't talking about it? Because it isn't. And I'm not as sanguine as you are about the possibility of it happening. And my assignment here today is to talk about why that is, why it's not being debated, and why so much of the left won't talk about it. It is good news that there are four panels here on this subject. That's a definite step forward. Let me add that 9/11 is on everybody's lips by contrast with the problem of election fraud and stolen elections, which is completely taboo. The theft of elections in this country is inextricably related to 9/11. If Bush Cheney hadn't stolen that election, 9/11 wouldn't have happened. Well, I don't want to get lost in the weeds here. Let me begin by reading to you a recent movie review that takes a shot at me. And this isn't just grandiosity or self-advertising. You'll see that it's directly related to the subject that we're dealing with today. This is from a review of a new documentary called The True Cost, which is about fashion, just coming out now. This review ran in the Daily Beast. It's written by a fashion writer named Lizzie Crocker. She goes through the film, and then she writes this: materialistic, money-grubbing Americans shouldn't kid themselves. All of that stuff they're buying is making them depressed, despite the promise of happiness and consumerism that the advertising industry is selling us. So much for the American dream. But this is where the film loses focus and credibility, criticizing not just the fashion industry, but the global capitalist system that supports it. NYU media professor Mark Crispin Miller denounces advertising as sinister propaganda. There's a scare quotes around propaganda and sinister. Quote, we think of propaganda as a totalitarian thing. We think of Hitler, but propaganda is actually as American as apple pie, Miller tells us. I think that's an uncontroversial observation. And in fact, the Daily Beast put that quote in a box at the side of the review, okay? So clearly it's something people will read and say, yeah, right? But Lizzie Crocker begs to differ. The film neglects to mention that Miller is a 9/11 truther. A once respected writer and political activist whose views have become too fringe for even the most extremist pockets of the mainstream. Yeah, right, what? I didn't know there were any extremist pockets in the mainstream, much less most extremist pockets. But however demented they are, I'm too psychotic even for them. By including people like Miller, the film presumes that its target audience is both ignorant and impressionable. Either we won't recognize Miller as a conspiracy theorist, or we will, but are too open-minded to dismiss his opinions about advertising. Yeah, just try to process that, okay? They're not opinions, you know. It's a historical fact. advertising is a form of propaganda. It's commercial propaganda. And into the 30s, in the advertising trade press, you'll find the word propaganda used by people in advertising to refer to what they do. But it's an opinion, and it's an opinion that on its face should be rejected out of hand, especially because of my background as a 9/11 truther. Okay, now, there's a few things to say about this. One is that, this is a kind of minor historical point, but it's worth making, that the charge of conspiracy theory is kind of descendant of red baiting, right? Because her entree to this attack on me and on the film for using me is the fact that the film is not content simply to take issue with advertising, but it actually raises questions about the global capitalist system that supports it, okay? Therefore, you know, the film has to be condemned and so on. But the more important point is that Lizzie Crocker is not at all unusual in her readiness to level this charge against me, even though I wasn't talking about 9/11 in the film. And even though I'm not actually, by any stretch of the imagination, a full-time 9/11 truther. I mean, I speak at events like this, I'm very sympathetic, but I can't pretend to be on the same level with people like Les and David Ray Griffin and so on. Nevertheless, the fact that I'm open to this at all is grounds for complete and utter condemnation, no matter what I'm talking about. So, you know, the bigotedness of this response is startling, but more important than that is the fact that it comes to her fingertips so readily. And that's the problem that we're up against. We're up against the problem of the conspiracy theory meme that anyone who talks about this is self-evidently nuts. That this is just crazy on its face that this would ever happen. I am confident in saying that Lizzie Crocker has never spent a second looking into the evidence that 9/11, I'm not even gonna say 9/11 was an inside job. I'm simply gonna say the copious evidence that the official story is preposterous. We can say that we can all agree, okay? The official story is preposterous. There is an enormous and ever-growing library of hard evidence to that effect. So why aren't we all talking about this? Why are the American people not discussing this? Why isn't this headline news? Why isn't there another commission planned? Which is the whole point of the 9/11 truth movement, is another commission. That's all it is. Precisely because that is a reasonable request and something that wouldn't be difficult to arrange, it is necessary to demonize the people who are asking for it. Now, conspiracy theory. My own career was indeed derailed. Lizzie Crocker's right about the fact that I once had entree to NPR radio shows. I talked often, I was writing about so-called popular culture. I wrote about TV. So reporters would always call me up to ask me what I thought of Britney Spears or, you know, some bolt like that. And advertising and so on, you know, harmless subjects. When I published Fooled Again, which argues that the 2004 election was stolen, as the expression has it, I couldn't get arrested. Although it's an unfortunate expression because who knows, right? But what I mean is I was blacklisted. The book was blacked out. I got 2 newspaper reviews in the whole country, 1 positive, 1 negative. Could not get any interviews on NPR. A friend of mine who has a small foundation in Philadelphia offered to put up the money to pay for ads for the book that would run on WHYY, which is the Philadelphia NPR affiliate. And they said, sure, we do that all the time. So he and I wrote some 30-second spots about the book, and he sent them in, and he didn't hear back. He followed up with a phone call, and they said, well, no, see, we don't really do political advertising. He said, we're not asking you to do political advertising. Mark Crispin Miller isn't running for office. He wrote a book about the 2004 election. And the reply to that was, we're not going to just advertise any book. I mean, we wouldn't advertise Mein Kampf.
What?
Yes. We wouldn't advertise Mein Kampf. Mein Kampf. All right. So I was a conspiracy theorist. Everybody who wrote about the issue was a conspiracy theorist. What I went through, Bob went through, Steve Freeman at Penn, is he? Went through, Bobby Kennedy Jr. went through. It's conspiracy theory. No matter how well argued, no matter how amply documented, we're talking about conspiracy theory. It can't be true. It's not possible. They wouldn't steal an election, not in this country, okay? They might do it in Russia or in Venezuela, but they're not going to do it here. It is self-evidently preposterous. Okay, I was so stunned by this because it was a major mainstream publishing house that did the book. It was Basic Books. And I even hired, as an outside publicist, Barbara Montero, who's Paul Krugman's publicist, and who has had much experience in getting people on shows like Charlie Rose and that. And she'd never seen anything like the brick wall that she ran into with Fooled Again. Now, I tell you all this, I'm not whining to you. I'm telling you this to explain why I decided to research the origins of that meme, conspiracy theory. When did that start? Where did that come from? Because the fact is, it's a fairly recent development. And I was in touch with Lance DeHaven Smith, as a name some of you may know, who had written a great essay on conspiracy theory. So I asked him to write a whole book on it for a series I was editing published by the University of Texas Press. And I strongly recommend the book to you if you haven't read it. It's called Conspiracy Theory in America. And what it demonstrates is the following. Until 1967, the phrase conspiracy theory rarely came up in American journalistic discourse. If you do a search in the archives of the New York Times, Washington Post, and Time Magazine, do a search on the phrase conspiracy theory, you find that it's rarely used, and when it is used, it's used in various ways, in various contexts. There's nothing consistent about its use. Suddenly, in 1967, it starts appearing all over the place, and increasingly, through the rest of the 60s and into the 70s and ever since, and it's always used in the same way. Well, I should say about 90% of the time, it's used in the same way. It's used to discredit arguably left critiques or discussions of state crimes against democracy. Okay, not just 9/11, but the Kennedy assassination, the Kennedy assassinations, I should say, Martin Luther King, Iran-Contra, the CIA's drug dealing in the inner city, election fraud, and latterly, the Boston Marathon bombing. We could go on, okay?
The sound quality for the next few minutes of Mark Crispin Miller's speech became inaudible. So here's a brief summary of what he said. In 1967, after two books came out that were critical of the Warren Commission, the CIA sent a memo to all of its station chiefs worldwide, urging them to use their propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of conspiracy theorists, and they even laid out the five tactics to be used to do this. And one was by using the phrase, if there was a real conspiracy going on, somebody would have talked. Mark Crispin Miller also said that he gets that one a lot concerning election fraud. If the election was stolen, someone would have talked.
You know? People have talked all over the place. But it doesn't matter. It's not the truth of the argument that matters. It's just its rhetorical efficacy. See? And then on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, we saw that these arguments were used again. They came up again. People actually still arguing with their bare faces hanging out that Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK alone, which is a ludicrous narrative. It's as ludicrous as the official 9/11 story. It's as ludicrous as the argument that Bush Cheney won the 2004 election because the Christian vote came out. The Christians suddenly started to multiply like Jesus' loaves and fishes and voted in huge multitudes that no one knew existed, and then he was reelected despite his record disapproval ratings and his unpopularity within the Republican Party and so on. That doesn't really matter. Fact is that the official truth is the truth, regardless of what you may say against it, and anything you say against it or say to question it is a conspiracy theory. It comes from the CIA. I would argue that it is probably the most effective propaganda drive in American history, maybe even world history. Because as Lance points out in his book, what it did, what it has done, is to effect a profound change in the worldview of the American people, who since the revolution have always been ready to believe that elites are capable of conspiracy against the rights and property of the American people. That is not a radical assumption. That's a common sense view. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory from beginning to end. That's what it is. The idea that elites were after us, that they couldn't be trusted, they were in cahoots with the British Empire and so on. This was common currency under Andrew Jackson, and through the 19th century, you find it in the writings of Abraham Lincoln. You know, it's just not that radical an idea. Moreover, it is a kind of natural and healthy suspiciousness that is essential to the maintenance of democracy. When you internalize this idea that there's something crazy about the thought of the elites conspiring like this, when you internalize that idea, you are crippled. You are incapacitated. You can't any longer talk honestly about what's going on and what the framers understood would happen. You spoke about how the state of war has had all these dire effects. Well, that's why the framers, and I'm not idealizing the framers. I mean, they, in their own way, they conspired against the common people and so on, and they defended slavery. We know all this. Nevertheless, they were classical small-R Republicans. They knew that you had to limit presidential power. You couldn't give the president power to declare war. You couldn't and shouldn't have a standing army. Compare that vision with what we have today, with this grotesque, distended military establishment that's both public and private, with a president who makes war constantly. I think this is the most warlike president we've ever had. The fact is that right in the American tradition, there has always been a kind of salutary distrust of executive power that's kind of vanished now. Because when people notice that something's fishy about a story that they've heard, they are always inclined to apologize by saying, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but. You've heard people say this, right? Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but. Then they'll say something perfectly reasonable that anybody would say. It's like, I'm not a feminist, but. You probably heard that too. I'm not a feminist, but. American history is in many ways a series of provocations, strategic provocations, like 9/11, although that's in a class by itself because it's so horrific. So the point I just made is that ideologically and philosophically, the 9/11 truth movement is actually as American as apple pie. Moreover, even a cursory awareness or understanding of American history allows us to recognize that this tactic of deliberately inflaming public opinion by arranging a provocative act goes all the way back to the Mexican War in the 1840s. You know, when James Polk deliberately sent General Zachary Taylor to Mexico and get the Mexicans to attack so that we could counterattack. This is arguably what happened to bring on the Spanish-American War when the Maine blew up, with the battleship Maine. And there's a tape of Bobby Kennedy actually discussing the explosion of the Maine during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he refers to it just in passing as a deliberate provocation by the U.S. FDR's record, I mean, we've talked about Pearl Harbor, and this is extremely upsetting to Democrats and liberals generally, and I understand why it is, but Pearl Harbor was not the only provocation that FDR, he was also, they were chasing U-boats all over the North Atlantic trying to get them to attack our ships, and Hitler was not going to take the bait because he didn't want to fight two wars at once, not because he was a great guy, okay, even though I am, of course, on a par with Hitler. My books are so similar to his works. Tell. And then we all know about the Gulf of Tonkin. That's something that we can instantly think of. After the Cuban Revolution, the personnel in Guantanamo began a series of provocations, including the abduction and murder of at least four Cuban nationals. The number of provocations by the U.S. military personnel at Guantanamo eventually numbered over 13,000. Cuba kept complaining about this to the UN. The Cubans weren't going to give them the benefit of succumbing to a provocation. So this is something that's happened time and time and time and time and time again. And since 9/11, we've seen this happen repeatedly with the anthrax mailings and, I believe, the Boston Marathon bombing and Charlie Hebdo. I mean, we can go on and on. Now, let me read you a passage from the Nuremberg Diary by G.M. Gilbert, who was an American psychiatrist who was assigned to Nuremberg prison. And he interviewed all of the accused, and one of them was Hermann Göring. And they had this fascinating exchange. Why, of course the people don't want war, Goering shrugged. Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best that he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia, nor in England, nor in America, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship or a parliament or a communist dictatorship. Gilbert is troubled by this, and he says, I mean, I could kiss the guy. Bless his heart. It's heartbreaking. He says, there is one difference, I pointed out. In a democracy, the people have some say in the matter through their elected representatives. And in the United States, only Congress can declare wars. Oh, that is all well and good, Goering replies. But voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That's easy. All you have to do is tell them that they're being attacked and denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. It's not controversial. Now, where's the left in all this? The more persuasive the 9/11 truth movement becomes, and the more people go online and pick stuff up that the mainstream media doesn't want them to know, and the more young people come of age unintimidated by the conspiracy theory meme, that's very important. And I've noticed this in my own classes. It keeps me going. It's like homophobia. I mean, they don't really care. They'll kind of look at the evidence and have a normal, sane reaction to it. The easier it gets, the more promising our prospects, the more the state ramps up their drive against us, slanderous and subversive efforts to cripple the movement. You may know that David Cameron last fall, in a speech before the UN, said that conspiracy theory is as dangerous as ISIS, okay? And he meant what we're doing, conspiracy theory. Recently, François Hollande, the socialist president of France, equated conspiracy theory with Nazism because, of course, anti-Semitism is based on an ancient conspiracy theory of, you know, Jewish machinations, etc. And here in our own country, as I'm sure you know, because the choir is here, Cass Sunstein, who's working for President Obama, co-wrote a piece for a journal published by Harvard University on cognitive infiltration that is using trolls deliberately to subvert discussions of 9/11 online. I mean, he actually talked about the necessity of disabling this dangerous terroristic discourse by using agents to go online posing as sympathizers, picking fights. I have no doubt also people will go on a 9/11 site and start talking about the protocols of the Elders of Zion and the Jewish world conspiracy so that the 9/11 movement gets tarnished with a kind of neo-Nazi brush. I mean, if I were doing this kind of thing, that's what I would do, right? So this isn't just empty words we're talking about. This is kind of manifest preparation to criminalize the kind of discussion we're having and to use all the powers of the state to shut it down. Now, where's the left? Where's the left in all this? Where is it? Let's go back to 67 when the CIA sent out this memo. Right around the same time, Ramparts, the leftist magazine, was breaking these amazing stories about what the CIA was up to. In 66, they broke the story of how Michigan State University had played a crucial role in propping up the Diem dictatorship in South Vietnam. A professor at MSU, Stanley Scheinbaum, blew the whistle on this because he was actually involved in the program and he realized they were training police at Michigan State University. This was broken by Ramparts. The following year, they broke the story of the National Student Association being subsidized by the CIA. That story exploded in the mainstream press. The New York Times did an excellent job following up on that story, interviewing kids who had unwittingly been dragged into the CIA operation, threatened with long federal jail terms if they told anybody about it. I mean, it was really harrowing. I cannot imagine anything like that happening now. I don't see the left any longer doing those kinds of exposés. And I believe that if you study the history of the New York Review of Books, and The Nation, even the New York Times Book Review, and other publications like that do a content analysis of those publications from then through the 70s and to now, you'll see that this kind of explosive content just stops. It stops. We don't see it anymore. And now we've come to the point where some of our most illustrious fellow leftists actually go out of their way to disavow any kind of discussion like the discussion we're having. I'm going to read you, I'm concluding with this. This is a passage from Disaster Capitalism by Naomi Klein, a work that's the subject of a panel here at the Left Forum, a book that I deeply admire, and I think the world of her. I mean, she's kind of a friend of mine. Nevertheless, I am struck by this passage. When the September 11th attacks hit, the White House was packed with Milton Friedman's disciples, including Donald Rumsfeld. The Bush team seized the moment of collective vertigo with chilling speed. Not, as some have claimed, because the administration deviously plotted the crisis, but because the key figures of the administration, veterans of earlier disaster capitalism experiments in Latin America and Eastern Europe, were part of a movement that prays for crisis the way drought-struck farmers pray for rain and the way Christian Zionist end-timers pray for the rapture. When the long-awaited disaster strikes, they know instantly that their moment has come at last. So they didn't have anything to do with its happening. They were just poised. Right. Poised to write the Patriot Act in 12 hours. You ever seen it? Yeah. You know, right? They just quickly wrote that because they were praying for a crisis, and it struck. They said, great, quick, hurry up. Let's get a few people and write that Patriot Act. Right? Now, what's especially remarkable about this is that Naomi Klein knows that the U.S. had actually itself been involved in some of those earlier disaster capitalism experiments in Latin America. It's in the same book. It's about 60 pages later. She talks about how the CIA and ITT worked to destroy Chilean democracy by arranging for the Pinochet coup. She writes very intelligently about this, that it wasn't like the U.S. was praying for a coup in Chile and then acted with chilling speed to take advantage of it. That coup was their doing. She knows this. What I therefore conclude, Naomi Klein just doesn't want to go there. I don't think it's a calculation. I think it's an instinctive thing. You go there, you are off the reservation. You are basically asking to be shot, metaphorically speaking. It's professional suicide. You're asking to be Gary Webbed. You know what I'm, you understand? Gary Webb, his life was destroyed by the charge of conspiracy theory. And I know journalists personally who, even journalists who've written about some of the major conspiracies of the last 30 years, they become anxious to the point of belligerence if you talk to them about this stuff. They don't want to go there, and it upsets them to be asked to go there because on some level, being serious journalists, they know that they should go there. But this has been such a successful effort to stigmatize a particular kind of necessary investigation that our journalists across the political spectrum have been disabled by it, you know? And I've seen it with election fraud. When Michael Moore, another friend, announced right after the 2004 election on his website that it was not stolen, it just wasn't. So the question becomes, how do we deal with this? I know a lot of people on the left, colleagues at NYU, staunch left people coming to this event who don't even know some of the basic stuff about what the 9/11 truth movement has unearthed. They have never heard it. It's like it's in a bad part of town and they would never go there. You know, they just have stayed away. So they will ask a sort of fundamental question that just leaves you gaping. And you have to reinvent the wheel and tell them all the stuff, you know? And sometimes they'll, yeah, wow, that's interesting. But that's the end of it. They won't then become interested enough to devote attention to it and circulate because it's disreputable. It's disreputable. So that's the challenge here. I'll stop there.
And that concludes the speech given by Mark Crispin Miller at the Left Forum in New York City on May 30th, 2015. You can find that speech and the Q&A that followed on YouTube by searching for Mark Crispin Miller and Left Forum. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.